Good afternoon. On this chilly day, I'd like to welcome everybody to Division One of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases scheduled for oral argument at 1:30. And the first one that I have down is Weldon v. Irwin Mortgage Corp. Are you the counsel for that case? Okay. So we'll hear oral argument first on that case. And the other one is City of Greeley v. Snyder. Are counsel here for that case? Okay, we'll hear argument next on that case. Are you planning on both arguing? Okay, very well. I just wanted to check. You may be seated. Let me just briefly review our procedures for everybody. I think you may be familiar with them, but we have 15 minutes for each side for oral argument, and we have a digital timer, so if you're the appellant, you should know how much time you want to reserve for your rebuttal argument. If you'd like me to remind you at a particular point, I'd be happy to do that. We also have color-coded timers that start out as green and then turn to amber when you have 5 minutes left and turn to red when your time is up. All of the judges have had a chance to read the briefs, and at least one of us has had a chance to review the record, so you may wish to focus the oral argument on the legal issues presented. You should know that there's a toggle switch on the podium that you can use to raise or lower it to suit your convenience. And you should also be aware that the oral arguments are posted on the internet. So if you have any confidential information, you may wish to be careful as to how you phrase that. And finally, I would ask everybody, if you have a cell phone with you, to make sure that it's turned off so that it doesn't inadvertently interrupt us during the course of our argument. So with all of those preliminaries taken care of, we're ready to hear the oral argument in Weldon v. Irwin Mortgage Corp.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. James Thorburn, number 21017, on behalf of the appellant Kimberly Weldon. Since summary judgment was granted in this case, this country has witnessed a meltdown of the mortgage lending industry. The aggressive lending practices of mortgage lenders has been exposed and made abundantly clear over the last year or so. This case is yet another example of the aggressive lending practices in the industry extensively damaging borrowers. It's not surprising, therefore, that today, other than a shell, one cannot find Irwin Mortgage. Irwin, a sophisticated lender, states in writing to an unsophisticated borrower that the home she is considering purchasing meets FHA requirements and is worth at least the contract price. Both statements are blatantly false. Irwin acknowledges that they were false. Effectively, Irwin's defense is a gotcha defense. You should have known that what we did earlier. Therefore, your claim is barred. The issues for appeal, should the order sending assault default judgment be set aside? Does the defendant have a procedural defense, a statute of limitations, when with respect to an open judgment? And did the trial court err by concluding as a matter of law that plaintiff's claims were barred under the applicable statute of limitations? With regard to the default judgment, there was no evidence presented by Irwin. It was just argument of counsel. Irwin's entire argument is that it thought it had 30 days instead of 20 in which to answer. In order for the judgment to be opened, it's clear under the Buckmiller case that the court had to make findings of fact under the Craig standard and show that each prong was satisfied. There was no findings of fact whatsoever in the court's orders. Now, it's one thing to say, well, maybe there were some facts in the record, as Irwin has argued, but Buckmiller is quite clear that just because there may be something in the record, that's not the same as a finding of fact by the trial court. And since the trial court made no findings of fact whatsoever, the default The order setting aside the default judgment or opening the default judgment should be set aside.
Mr. Thurburn?
Yes.
If we were to agree with your argument in that regard, would the remedy be to remand this issue to the trial court to make findings or simply to reverse in your favor?
I believe that would be to reverse in our favor because there are absolutely no findings. It's not an issue of going back and trying to fix something that may have been broken a little bit. I mean, it was just a total breakdown there. So I think it's a reversal versus sending it back, remanding for further proceedings.
So, and let me ask you one more question about this issue. With regard to the question of the Irwin's reason for not filing an answer in a timely manner, are you familiar with the cases that distinguish between ordinary negligence and gross negligence?
Yeah, gross negligence is the counsel, I believe you're talking about. And yes, and this is just ordinary negligence. If you believe what was in the pleadings, arguments of counsel, counsel didn't even receive the file until after the motion for default judgment had been filed with the court. So it couldn't have been gross negligence of counsel, where he got it 5 days and he let it sit for 25 days. That's not the case here. This is just ordinary negligence of a sophisticated lender who had hundreds of cases in the 18th Judicial District at the time this happened and claimed, oh, we thought we had 30 days. So, no, I don't believe that this was a gross negligence of counsel issue. With respect to the opened judgment, and I don't think anybody disagrees that this judgment was opened rather than voided here. Next question is, should the plaintiff had been allowed to have the case heard on the merits? And again, the question is whether a statute of limitations defense is procedural or on the merits. And going to the public policy issues of that argument, we've obviously briefed it quite extensively. One who requests equity ought to do equity. They're saying on the one hand, hey, please forgive us for our blowing effectively a statute of limitations. We blew it, but please forgive us. Our negligence wasn't really that bad. And then, but let us go in and hammer the other side on effectively the same type of issue. I don't think that from an equitable standpoint that should happen. If they're going to be forgiven the statute of limitations, it's an open judgment. The case law is very clear that it should be heard on the merits, that they shouldn't be able to go back and say, well, we've got this procedural defense, and you forgave our procedural problem, but don't forgive their procedural problem. I think if it goes one way, it should go the other way as a matter of public policy.
Let me ask you one question about that. What about the First National Bank v. Mock case that Irwin cites in his brief that says that asserting a statute of limitations is a meritorious defense?
That is a 1922 case, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's
and
correct.
It's a meritorious defense. But the later cases are very clear that a statute of limitations defense is procedural. It's not, you do not have a determination of the case on the merits if it's dismissed by a statute of limitations. And under statute of limitations, the case law is quite clear. It's not not losing the right, but losing the remedy. And so if the case is barred under statute of limitations after the judgment's been opened, what it's saying is that you're never going to get to the merits, even though it's a meritorious defense under the 1922 case. The later cases all say that you don't go to the merits if it's dismissed on statute of limitations. The court concluded as a matter of law that that plaintiff's claims were barred under the statute of limitations. Again, we have unsophisticated single mom who, as a matter of law, was required by the court to understand all of the intricacies of lending law, FHA regulations, USDA regulations, and somehow she was supposed to be able to put all of this together before 2005 when her real estate broker said, you might have a problem. She was supposed to be able to put this all together and say, oh, I've got a claim.
What about the fact that the accrual statutes for the statute of limitation both speak in terms of whether somebody knew or reasonably should have known? Doesn't that make a difference in terms of whether or not Ms. Weldon was a single mom who wasn't sophisticated because of the reasonableness standard?
Of course. I mean, that is part of the falls into the mix. Was she sophisticated enough to understand and have notice of these issues? And the court
doesn't the statute require that we look not only at whether she knew, whether she actually knew, but whether she reasonably should have known?
Reasonably should have known. Correct. And as a matter of law, remember what this, what the question is here, is not whether the court in its discretion could have determined that she reasonably should have known. This was as a matter of law. She had to have known. And so that's a stretch to say as a matter of law. All the facts were not before the court. This was a summary judgment motion. And so the question was, she heard from the USDA that there was manufactured housing. Okay, what does that mean? As a matter of law, she should have known that meant that because the USDA was unwilling to refinance, that it did not meet FHA guidelines, totally different system, and that the value was substantially impacted as a matter of law. We say, no, not as a matter of law. The court may be able to determine that as a matter of fact after hearing all the evidence, but not as a matter of law. And I'd like to reserve my remaining 4 minutes.
Very well, Mr. Thurber.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Eric Accomazzo for Irwin Mortgage Corporation. First, Your Honor, let me respond to the kind of gratuitous attack of the lending industry that we heard from Mr. Thornburn first.
I don't think you need to respond to what you perceive as a gratuitous attack on the lending industry. We would prefer that you just address the issues that are before us this afternoon, Mr. Accomazzo.
Yes, sir. With respect to the background, let me just explain something about the FHA mortgage insurance program that is the basis of the plaintiff's claims for misrepresentation. The plaintiff claims that the misrepresentation by Irwin at the inception of this loan back in 2001 was that the property did not meet FHA guidelines and that its value was not the $100,000 that was appraised by an independent appraiser, Mr. Peterson. I would point out that the FHA insurance program is mortgage default insurance that's entered into between the federal government and the lender. It insures the lender against default. It is not an insurance that is for the benefit of the borrower, in this case, Ms. Weldon. So similarly, the appraisal that's done at the beginning of this process is done for the benefit of the lender. So the plaintiff's claims are basically that the appraisal and the FHA insurance that were for the benefit of the lender somehow were actually for the benefit of the borrower. Now, getting to the legal issues here, Your Honor, and that's just incorrect. The default judgment was properly set aside. I think it's important to look at the policy behind these rules. And the policy behind the cases that deal with setting aside default judgments are that resolution of disputes on their merits is favored. That's kind of the key public policy that is cited in these cases as you review them. In Craig versus Ryder, which is a seminal case here, the court said resolution of disputes on their merits is favored, and we have been receptive to promptly filed motions to set aside defaults. The kind of competing public policy to that is the finality of judgments. And when you look at the time periods here at issue, Irwin's answer was filed about a week late, and before it was, and then it was overturned. And plaintiff's judgment was in effect for about 1 month. So when you look at these time periods, the issue about finality of judgment is really not a major consideration because the judgment was only in effect for a very short time.
Well, Mr. Akamazo, what is your response to Mr. Thorburn's point that the trial court erred in not making findings under the three-pronged test under Buckmiller?
The response, Your Honor, is that the way the judge ruled here was that there was a very detailed motion that considered all the factors, the Craig factors regarding setting aside default judgments. There was a very detailed motion, and what happened here in this age of electronic filing is that the judge stamped that, put an electronic stamp saying motion granted. When you look at the motion that he was referring to, it had all the facts laid out. It had all the conclusions of law laid out. So first answer, Your Honor, is that what the judge did here was the equivalent of findings of fact and conclusions of law. Secondarily, Your Honor, there would be no use remanding this back to the trial court for the judge to consider this because it would be simply harmless error. Even if the judge made a mistake by not setting out separate findings of fact and conclusions of law, it really makes no difference here. The fact is that the judge did consider the facts and the law, and by granting the motion and affixing that granting of the motion to the actual fixing his order to the motion, it's clear that what was intended there was the findings of fact and conclusions of law set out in the motion.
Well, let me now turn now to the question of excusable neglect and ask you the same question I asked Mr. Thorburn. Are you familiar with the cases that regarding setting aside a default judgment that distinguish between ordinary and gross negligence?
Frankly, Your Honor, I'm not. I did not focus on those cases.
Okay. So, then you may just proceed with your argument.
Okay.
Then.
With respect to, and I would point out, Your Honor, with respect to setting aside the default judgment, what the plaintiff is asking for, I think, is unprecedented here. If you look at the cases on setting aside default judgments, they're all appeals of cases where a motion to set aside the default judgment was denied. I think there is no case law that supports what the plaintiff is asking here, that when a motion to set aside the default judgment is granted, that after the case is gone and proceeded to the merits and been decided against the plaintiff, that the plaintiff can go back and try to avoid the decision on the merits by reinstating the default judgment. There's no precedent to support that.
Was there any reason, though, that would prevent us from agreeing with Mr. Thorburn's argument, though, even if there isn't any precedent?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that the reason there isn't any precedent is because of the strong public policy in favor of resolving disputes on the merits. And I would submit that's why there isn't any precedent. So.
Well, okay, I just want to make sure that there's no other barrier, though. I mean, if we were to determine that the trial court had not applied the Buckmiller factors, hadn't made findings of fact, then you would agree that it would be possible to reverse, even though there's no specific precedent on point.
I would say it would be unprecedented, but not impossible, certainly,
okay.
Certainly, Your Honor. With respect to the plaintiff's argument that a default judgment, once entered then and then set aside, bars affirmative defenses, I would suggest that we try to think about what policy goal would be met by a rule like that. Why should a case where a default judgment is entered and then been set aside be barred? Why should a defendant be barred from being allowed to present defenses? I would suggest, Your Honors, that there's no rational public policy that would support such a rule. Why, in one case where a default judgment was set aside, is a defendant barred from asserting affirmative defenses? And in an exact case just like that, where there wasn't a default judgment, why would that defendant be able to present defenses? There's just no rational policy supporting the proposed rule of the plaintiff. Furthermore, in this case also, there is no precedent. The plaintiffs have not cited any cases where a court has held that this is the effect of a default judgment that has been set aside. And I would submit also that the reason there's no precedent is that there's no good policy supporting the proposed rule of the plaintiff. The case which set up this distinction between vacating a judgment when there's jurisdictional challenge and opening a judgment under other grounds is the Weaver case. And in that case, the concept was important because the plaintiffs had recorded a judgment lien, and there was a question of whether the plaintiff would lose their judgment lien if they were not allowed to keep the judgment in effect through the end of the case. There's none of that sort of consideration here. The plaintiffs cite a couple other cases, Gallegos and Waskell, for the idea that their proposed rule that once a default judgment enters and been set aside, it bars affirmative defenses. But those cases were not in the context of motions to set aside default judgments. So we would suggest, Your Honor, that they are inappropriate. And again, I just point the court to the fact that there's no precedent for what the plaintiff is suggesting here, and they're really proposing a new rule that is not supported by the case law. Also, with respect to this issue of barring affirmative defenses, once a default judgment is set aside, the defendant is clearly entitled to answer, and an answer under Rule 8 includes responding to the averments of fact, but also responding with affirmative defenses. That's right there in the rule. And as Judge Holmes stated in the order granting summary judgment, just looking at the rules indicates that the plaintiff's theory that affirmative defenses are barred just doesn't work. Now, with respect to the summary judgment on the statute of limitations, the plaintiff claims that there was a misrepresentation with respect to the fact of FHA financing and with respect to the value of the home. If you look at the timing here, Your Honor, the loan was made in May of 2001. In 2003, Ms. Weldon applied for a loan to the USDA, and she was turned down for that loan because it was a manufactured home. And it is that time, at that point, the trial court ruled that Ms. Weldon knew that her home was not eligible for financing because it was a manufactured home.
Not eligible for financing by the USDA, but is that the equivalent as not eligible under FHA?
It's the same thing. It relates back to the key issue of a manufactured home. What the plaintiff is really complaining about here is that a manufactured home does not have the same value as a stick-built home. And so regardless of whether her financing was denied by the USDA or the FHA, the underlying reason for the denial is because it's a manufactured home, which, according to the plaintiff's theory, implies a lesser value.
Of course, there's a distinction between a pre-1976 manufactured home and a post-1976?
Under FHA guidelines, there is, Your Honor, but it's undisputed that the plaintiff knew that her home was built prior to 1976. That's because of the insurance certificate that she was provided at the time of the closing in 2001. So she knew that. So all the information that was needed to understand that the home was not eligible for FHA financing was available to her in 2003, which is 4 years before the statute of limitations expired.
Counsel, I really hate to ask you about a case that's outside the briefs, but there was a recent case that a panel of this court handed down about 2 weeks ago, Heiss versus Lott, and it had to do with appraisals of mobile homes and modular homes. And in that case, it talked about how these terms have been used, you know, interchangeably and in miscellaneous contexts, such that it would need to be the subject of expert testimony. And you're saying that an ordinary person should be able to understand that manufactured home means pre-1976 manufactured home, which means mobile home?
I think the real issue here is the value. That's the base, the real basis for the plaintiff's claim, is that the plaintiff claims that her home did not have the value of $100,000 that it was appraised at. And this idea that you couldn't get financing, the FHA is only one form of financing. There's also conventional financing. The idea that there was a misrepresentation regarding the type of finance that could be gotten, we think is just not supported by the record, first of all, in that there is, for example, the plaintiff relies on the appraisal, but the plaintiff admits in the appellate brief that the plaintiff did not receive the appraisal until several years after the loan closing. So how can that be the basis for this claimed misrepresentation? But did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Thank you.
Getting back to the timing, the loan was closed May 10th, 2001. In May 2003, Ms. Weldon applied for a loan to the USDA. She was turned down because it was a manufactured home. In May 2003, she informed Irwin of this fact, of the USDA denial. During that, around August of 2003, she was involved with trying to modify her promissory note with Irwin. Then it's in July of 2005 that she claims that she learned of that the appraisal did not indicate that her home was manufactured housing. What the court found was that from May 2003, that's when Ms. Weldon knew all the facts that were necessary regarding her claimed injury and claimed damages. And we submit, Your Honor, that it's supported by the record, and this appeal should be denied.
Well, thank you, Mr. Akamazo.
With respect to the FHA issues of whether or not there would be liability to the lender, the Hoffman v. Stamper case, which we cite in our briefs, makes it very clear the lender is liable in this type of case. Irwin Mortgage was a defendant in that same case and raised the same defenses that are being made in this case. And the Hoffman court said, no, you are liable, Irwin. With regard to the issue of the stamping of the motion, Rule 121 requires a proposed order of accompanying any motion. If counsel had complied with that requirement, we may not be having that discussion, because counsel may have gone through and made all the findings for the judge, and the judge would have been able to sign that. But merely saying granted does not mean that the court agreed with everything that was in that motion. The court may have used other criteria. We're only speculating, as Buck Miller says. There. said that there was no recorded judgment lien. I believe that if the court reviews the electronic file, you will see that a transcript of judgment was issued and recorded. And so, yes, there was a recorded judgment lien in this case also before before the default was set aside. And again, it's an open judgment. So the judgment was still in effect. Saying that we are trying to set a rule that all affirmative defenses should go away. No. Procedural defenses. Failure to mitigate damages, which is an affirmative defense, that goes to the substance of the claim. That doesn't go to procedure. And for the rules that we had set, or for the reasons that we said earlier, we think that one who requests equity ought to do equity. The it it is disputed that Ms. Weldon knew that this home was built in 1970 there. They have a document. There's nothing in the record that shows that she read the document. It was an insurance document. There's nothing, and to get to the point where they have to go, she would have to conclude that she read the document in 2000, had an appreciation what it was about, that 3 years later she would have remembered the document, and that she had this information, and as you were saying, and I wasn't familiar with the Lott case, but yes, I agree, this is expert testimony stuff, and that she should be on some type of notice that all of this would put her on notice that it did not meet FHA guidelines. And we're not saying that it was because it was a manufactured home. Like we say in our briefs, it doesn't matter whether or not it was a manufactured home. Doesn't matter, because there was nothing to say that there were damages at that time. It was when we found out there were damages associated with this, and that was 2005. And it should be noted that she did not receive the appraisal, and it's in the record, and our responses to request for admissions attached to their motions. She did not receive the appraisal until July of 2005. So she did not even know what was in that appraisal until July 2005. But they are asking this court, as a matter of law, to state that she had notice of what was in that appraisal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thorburn. Thank you again, Mr. Accomazzo. We appreciate both of your arguments.